Welcome to the latest Funds Fan podcast. I'm Kyle Caldwell, your host. I am the collectives editor at Interactive Investor. Coming up later on the podcast is an interview with the UK fund manager of the best performing UK fund since the start of 2020, a period which we, as all now know, includes the COVID-19 market sell-off and the subsequent market recovery. But for the first part of the podcast, I am, as usual, joined by Tom Bailey, the ETFs editor at Interactive Investor, to chat through a couple of news items. Me and Tom are going to start off with Teddy Smith. Last week, Smith, who writes to all his investors twice a year, took the opportunity in his summer letter to point out the FundSmith equity has outperformed the MSCI World Index in the first half of 2021. He pointed out that this has played out despite the market rotation, which since last November has been a tailwind for value shares and proved to be a headwind for growth shares. FundSmith Equity invests in growth companies. Tom, he got a couple of things off his chest in the letter. Could you run through the main highlights regarding what Smith said?
Yeah, sure. So as you said, it was noted in the letter that FundSmith Equity outperformed the MSCI World Index in the first 6 months of the year. But you know, Terry Smith's not someone to just kind of make too much of a point out of short term performance. For him, it was a wider point we made here that this happened despite this kind of market rotation to value shares and cyclical shares, which would be it would be the kind of environment which you'd expect a FundSmith to underperform in, but you know it didn't. And so there's kind of a wider point here that he's trying to make the point that value stocks they're often bad companies, and that actually really long-term investment returns, you just want to look at you want good businesses and kind of forget this attempt to try and time different types of shares at different times. So he says you could have bought value shares from November and seen strong returns, but you'd have to try and get all that timing right. If you're a long-term investor, it's much better, in his view, to actually stick to good companies. So he says in the letter, no amount of recovery or low valuation will turn a poor business into a good one, and quality is the main determinant of long-term performance.
It does also go to show that not all growth funds will underperform when those types of companies are out of favour, and vice versa. I mean, there's been a lot that's been said about the challenging decade it has been for value shares, and by extension, value-focused funds and investment trusts. But there have been some that have performed well over the past decade. One that springs to mind is the River and Mercantile UK Recovery Fund, which is a member of Interactive Investors' Super 60 list. Smith's letters are always an enjoyable read. I got the impression that he thinks there's been too many column inches written about the market rotation towards value shares. But since mid-June, the value rally has somewhat fizzled out. Investors have been switching their focus back to growth companies on the grounds of being more unsure regarding whether a strong economic recovery will play out. Among the concerns since mid-June that have made investors become a bit more cautious include the Delta variant and higher inflation potentially being here to stay rather than being temporary. The view of both the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England is that inflation will be temporary. But some investors disagree and fear that inflation will remain high in order to do the heavy lifting to reduce the huge government borrowing that's taken place in response to the pandemic. One risk is that inflation becomes structural and hard to control, forcing an earlier than expected rise in interest rates.
Yeah, so obviously the dovish line in inflation is basically that higher inflation readings we've seen the last few months are temporary. They're caused by the reopening, very strong demand, and also combined with continued supply chain bottlenecks from disruptions that started last year with lots of businesses cancelling orders and then trying to bring back orders online after they realised there wasn't going to be this huge drop in demand for physical goods that was anticipated. So the hope is, central banks are banking on, is that once capacity catches up with demand and all the COVID-induced gluts in the supply chain are worked out, assuming more don't arise, which obviously is a risk now with the spread of the Delta variant to Southeast and East Asia. But the hope is that these will be worked out, these gluts in supply, and yeah, and you'll see inflation rates go back down. And you're kind of already seeing some evidence of this in Europe and North America. But the risk, obviously, is that inflation expectations become anchored. So it's kind of one of the strange things about inflation is it's really it's all about expectations. So if I'm a business and I think inflation is going to go higher, I raise prices. If I'm a worker and I think inflation is going to go up, I demand higher wages. So inflation expectations essentially become reality. But a key addition to this has been that central banks as a whole appear to become less hawkish on inflation, especially over the last couple of years, with this idea that the sort of policy they pursued in the 2010s was maybe damaging to growth, that you know maybe they should let inflation run a bit higher to account for when inflation's gone too low and to let labor markets recover. So if this kind of changes expectations that you know the central banks of the main economies of the world are less likely to raise rates at the first signs of higher inflation, then that kind of changes expectations, and you can get this kind of this spiral perhaps emerge. But you know that's not for sure will happen, because at the same time, lots of the kind of disinflationary forces that kind of since the 1980s that have kept inflation in check and quite low are still there. So labor unions in North America and Western Europe is still relatively weak to how they used to be. So wage rises won't come in such force as they used to. Globalization is still potentially deflationary. Technology is still deflationary, and deregulated industry, which keeps markets competitive and prices in theory low, it's also in theory still there.
Well, it's certainly a concern among a lot of investors and fund managers at the moment, and of course we will. It's a topic that we will be continuing to cover on the Interactive Investor website. We're now going to move on to investment trust dividends. There was new research out this week which found that investment trust dividends fell in the first half of this year. Tom, you covered the research. Could you run through the main points?
Yeah, sure. So the collective payment of investment trusts in the first half of this year declined by 3.1%. It's quite notable because this is the first decline in more than a decade. So investment trusts previously collectively cut payments in the second half of 2010. So it's kind of in the wake of the financial crisis. And it could seem quite surprising, particularly that they're cutting dividends now and not say last year when now you're seeing dividend payments recover. So in the first half of this year, underlying dividends for UK listed companies were up by 8%. But you've got to remember, it's a lag effect. The dividends are paid from companies into the trust and it works itself out later on. But the report also noted that investment trust dividends performed very well if you view them over a bit of a longer time frame. So maybe 6 months is a bit of it's a half a year, but we should maybe look at a kind of broader time frame of, say, the start of the pandemic. So between January 2020, which you can say is kind of the start of it really, and June 2021, UK dividends from companies fell by almost 35% on an underlying basis. Global dividends declined by almost 6%. In contrast, investment trusts were still able to raise their payments by a collective 2%.
In response to the research, the Association of Investment Companies, which is the trade body for the investment trust industry, pointed out that investment companies investing in alternative assets were not included in the research. And if they were, then dividends across the whole sector would have risen by 11% during the six-month period.
Yeah, the AIC also reiterated a point they made earlier, these statistics to show how investment trust dividends held up much better compared to open-ended funds during the pandemic. So for the full year 2020, more than four-fifths of extra income-paying investment trusts increased or maintained their dividend to shareholders despite the impact of the pandemic. In contrast, less than a quarter, so it's just like 23% of extra income-paying open-ended funds increased their dividends in 2020.
And as you mentioned, Tom, overall, over the 18-month period, investment trust dividends have held up very well. And the sector has once again passed the test for being reliable dividend payers, even when there's a dividend drought. This, as those familiar with the investment trust structure will know, is due to the fact that investment trusts can hold back 15% of income generated each year from their underlying investments. And that's held back in the dividend reserves. And when there's a shortfall, as there was last year, due to scores of dividends being cut in response to the pandemic or cancelled or paused. Those reserves can be tapped into. Various investment trusts utilised the structure and went into their dividend reserves, and that's why the majority of equity income paying investment trusts either increased or maintained their dividends throughout the pandemic. Open-ended funds, on the other hand, are obliged to return however much in dividends are paid by the companies held in the fund back to investors each year. They cannot hold any of the income back for a rainy day. My fund manager guest for this episode is Chris McVeigh, fund manager of the Octopus UK Multicap Income Fund. Firstly, Chris, could you give a brief overview of your investment style and approach and what the split is between large, medium and small size companies?
The UK Multicap Income Fund, an Octopus, it's an equity income product with a bias towards small and mid-cap companies that we believe have got the ability to grow faster than their larger peers. The funds is a portfolio of UK quoted companies, which we believe are capable of delivering earnings growth and therefore dividend growth ahead of the market. The case for UK equity income is well understood. You know, investors are looking for sustainable and hopefully growing income, green dividends, with the potential for capital growth. However, when we were looking to launch this fund back in December 18, there were some key concerns that we had, particularly around asset concentration, dividend cover, and lack of growth amongst many of the more traditional large cap focused UK equity income funds. Many of them are holding the same big FTSE 100 dividend payers, your Rios, your Shell, BP, etc. We take an alternative approach. We've taken a multi-cap approach to this portfolio construction, meaning that we can select stocks from across the entire UK equity market and therefore focus on progressive, faster growing small and mid-cap companies. That's not to the exclusion of the FTSE. We do have some names there as well. But we as a team at Octopus, we have experience within the small mid-cap arena. We run about 3 billion already within UK small quota small and mid-cap equities. So it's very much our bread and butter. And therefore the fund, whilst it is a multi-cap fund, has got a bias towards these faster growing small and mid-cap businesses. With regard to the size split, the question there, about 15% of the portfolio is in companies with a market cap in excess of 3 billion, another 10% in companies with a market cap of between 1 and 3 billion. The vast majority of holdings, therefore, are within companies with a market cap of between 100 million and a billion. About 5% of the portfolio is below that. We take what we call a bottom-up approach to investing. We use our core satellite approach. That's what we have across the other mandates as well in the team. What that means is the core of the portfolio is made of companies which we believe can grow earnings and grow dividends ahead of the market and will ultimately be substantially larger enterprises over our 3 to 5 year investment horizon. Hopefully they can double in that period. That's certainly our core aim, but certainly be substantially larger than they are at the time of investment. The portfolio also operates with two groups of satellites. One group is offering lower growth characteristics in the short term, but superior sustainable dividends, whereas the other group of satellites will be paying a lower near-term dividend, but off their portfolio really exceptional growth opportunities and scope, again, to grow dividends over the medium term. We launched this product back in December 18, as I said, with a target dividend yield of 4%. We delivered 4.4 in 2019, and we are currently on a run rate of 3.6. And on target, we hope to get back up to that 4% over the coming quarters.
The fund has performed very well since the start of last year. I ran the numbers on FE Analytics and found that the fund had been the best performer in the UK equity income sector. That's the investment associations. From the 1st of January last year to the 1st of August of this year, returning just over 29%. In contrast, the sector average is flat at 0.2% over that time period. So what have been the main drivers behind the fund performing well during both falling and rising markets?
It hasn't felt like an easy period, Kyle. And yeah, it's been an interesting period to be running an equity income mandate in light of what we've seen with regards to dividend cuts. So, I mean, with regard to performance over the pandemic, the more things changed, the more they really stayed the same. We made very few asset allocation changes through the period. We did take advantage of some extreme market moves to add to some positions which we believed had been oversold, but we really maintained that core that I talked about. And you know, it's something if we were to talk again in a year's time, the core of the portfolio would, I'd hope, remain largely as it is. Earlier in the pandemic, we did reduce some of our exposure to stocks related to consumer lending. We had some concerns, obviously, how things would fare with regard to the consumer unemployment levels in the face of a significant economic slowdown. So we took a bit of exposure off there, not much, but we did a little bit, and we reallocated that capital towards areas of the market where we felt trading would prove more resilient and where we had some comfort that dividends would be paid, and areas, as you might expect, supermarkets, et cetera, were ones that we bought a little bit into. Early on in the pandemic as well, we saw some really quite extreme price movements, which the fund took advantage of. One of the fund's growth satellites and strongest contributors since we launched the product has been a stock called Future PLC. It is an owner of various media assets. You'll see earlier in the week they announced the acquisition of some titles, including Money Week, etc., which I'm sure many of your listeners will be familiar with. It's a business which takes these assets and generally utilizes its core technology to monetize better online. So therefore, it's a business which benefits from e-commerce volumes, and indeed, it's had a series of upgrades to analyst estimates over recent periods. This stock was one which got significantly sold off at early stages of the pandemic, got down to about £6 back in March last year. It had been as high as £14 in February, just to give you an idea of the pullback. And it's currently trading in the high 30s. It was these types of wild swings that the fund was able to be relatively nimble on and take advantage of during the times of extreme volatility, and add to some of its positions, which we believed had been hugely oversold and wrongly so at the time. But it, you know, we aren't a trading fund. It isn't just a case of short-term trading. We're very much focused on that long-term progressive growth. We're focused on businesses which we class as, I say, progressive, which we are fully expecting to grow through the cycle ahead of the market, and that's exactly what we've seen. So, what's driven performance? Well, it's been that resilient underlying core within the portfolio. It's been the vast majority of companies that we have within the portfolio have been coming back to the market and updating with ahead of consensus guidance. That's been hugely reassuring. So we haven't felt the need to change much through the period. As I say, we've emerged from the pandemic in good shape, and we've seen our portfolio holdings recovering extremely, extremely well, as we'd have hoped they would have done when we entered this crisis.
Have the majority of firms now returned to paying dividends among your holdings?
The vast majority have. I mean, every single position within the fund has to be paying a dividend or indicating the intention to do so before it gets included in the fund. Yes, the vast majority have returned to paying dividends as we expected they would do. Some of them cut them, obviously, for balance sheet protection purposes. Other ones cut them during the crisis, arguably for optics, for politics. They didn't want to be seen to be paying out dividends to shareholders at times when things were clearly challenged. As we entered the crisis, the portfolio had dividend cover of 2.3 times. That's well in excess of the market at the time. It currently has dividend cover of over 3 times. And therefore, we'd fully expect to see some further dividend progression from the existing guidance as management teams feel increasingly comfortable with regard to the trading environment post-pandemic. There are still a couple of companies which are in the portfolio which haven't reinstated dividends. Young's PLC is one. That's the Southeast-focused pub and hotel company. But the board of Young's has stated that it intends to resume paying dividends as soon as appropriate. So we also believe that Young's will come out in a significantly stronger competitive position. So we're very happy to remain shareholders. But yes, it's been reassuring to see the vast majority of stocks have been reinstating dividends. There's very few exceptions which haven't. And certainly given the cover that we have in the fund just now and the consensus numbers, we'd expect that dividend growth to continue.
I wanted to now move on to ask you about portfolio activity of late. What have been your latest buys and sells in the fund?
As we talked about earlier on, we don't make regular changes to the portfolio. There's been a lot of noise in the UK equity market around takeovers over recent months. However, we've been also hugely reassured to see a significant number of exciting prospects coming to the UK equity market to IPO. And I think the pandemic's been helpful from that perspective. Companies have seen the benefits of the depth of capital available on the public markets. And I think that companies therefore using the private equity route, arguably over gearing themselves and facing a challenge that we had last year's, isn't some places that certain management teams would like to be. So, IPO market's been extremely strong, and we hope that will continue. Having said that, we're extremely selective when looking to add new positions, particularly IPO, when we've yet to get to know the businesses properly. We really prefer to focus on adding to our existing or current positions when appropriate. Things that we've added to recently, one of the fund's largest holdings, Brickability. It's the UK's leading brick factor and a building products distributor. It recently raised £55 million to part fund the acquisition of a competitor called Taylor Maxwell. It's also a leading supplier of bricks, timber, cladding products, etc. We backed at that point. We had a very reassuring meeting recently with the management of Brickability following its full year results. We think this business is extremely well placed to continue to grow strongly from its organic base, as well as the benefits from the acquisition, the economies of scale, etc. And we believe the stock is at still an extremely attractive valuation. It's paying an attractive dividend of over 2%. And that dividend is expected to grow at about 10% per annum. So that's the sort of thing we like to add to. It's, say, one of our largest positions, and we still expect it to re-rate and grow from here significantly. So that's one we're very happy to buy into. Another position which we added to recently was one of the fund's growth satellites, a business called Learning Technologies. It's focused on services and technology for digital learning, for talent management. It recently raised £85 million to acquire a US-listed business called GP Strategy. So it's quite nice to see UK businesses out there consolidating over other international businesses. You hear also about it coming the other way, but Learning Tech were out there picking off a business in the States. That's a large e-learning business as well. We think Learning Technologies, whilst it isn't a cheap stock, we're backing the management to significantly improve the operations, particularly within GP Strategies, and drive earnings upgrades and help bolster the impressive growth track record that Learning Tech has. The stock's only paying a modest 0.5% dividend yield, but again, it's expected to grow nicely from current levels. Again, that's another example of sort of things we've been trying to add to the portfolio and when opportunistic and when right to do so.
You mentioned earlier the fund has a current yield of around 3.6%. So what's your outlook for dividend growth for 2021? What do you think the fund could achieve?
Yeah, as I say, the fund's currently running about 3.6. Pre-crisis in 2019, it delivered 4.4. We are comfortable that the fund will grow back to being a 4% run rate product. That's certainly what we marketed on when we launched it, and certainly what we think is achievable. We think that's going to be achievable over the next couple of quarters. Looking across the portfolio, doing the analysis and the growth, if the positions were unchanged over the last year, the fund would be benefiting from 24% dividend growth over the last year. Clearly, that's partly reflective of the dividend cuts that we saw last year. So I think probably more reflective of the underlying growth within the portfolio. If we look at the year ahead, we'd expect to see dividend growth across the portfolio if the positions remain unchanged of just shy of 10% for the year end of December 22. If you compare that against a FTSE, I think that looking to be obviously seeing again great growth this year, but I think the year to December 22 is expected to be relatively flat again at 3.8% dividend yield to the FTSE. So, we'd hope to be growing more quickly than the FTSE, and we'd hope to be paying a dividend higher than the FTSE offshore as well. So, again, hopefully that resonates with investors.
And finally, Chris, a question that we ask all fund managers appearing on the podcast. Do you personally invest in the Octopus UK Multicap Income Fund?
I'd hope that everyone you ask that question to, Kyle, says yes, they do. Otherwise, yeah, you got to back yourself. Absolutely. I mean, the entire quoted team at Octopus, all nine of us, have investments in this fund, as we do also within the other OEIC that we manage. Whilst I do tell my wife I have a very balanced portfolio with regards to my pension, the fund is by far the largest investment that I have from a personal perspective. And indeed, my goddaughter, who I manage a trust for, also happens to have a stake in this as well. So it's a better work. But no, we absolutely back with the mandates that we manage and we invest in them because we believe ultimately they will grow and they will continue to outperform.
That's all for this episode. I hope you've enjoyed listening. And if that's the case, then please do give us a like, tell your friends, and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Of course, you can find lots more investment insight and ideas at ii.co.uk. We'll be back in early September.